coming at you all the way live from the lower bottoms of West Oakland. This is Sound Waves. I'm talking today with good friend of show. Can I just say the show, the official show economist? Can I just say that?
I'm good with that.
All right. Every time I talk about you, I'm just going to be honest with you. Every time I talk about you and I get all excited, I'm like, I'm about to have the economist. Oh, the economist is coming back on. I'm like, yeah.
You're too kind.
Breaking it down. Jobs report came out recently. NBC reported that the unemployment rate is down. I don't know how much that had to do with certain states relaxing their reopening guidelines and getting a few people back to work, states like Texas and even here in California. That being said, they're locking back down because of a surge in coronavirus cases. We saw for the past week, every day, a record-breaking number of a surge in coronavirus cases. We still have only had one stimulus check in the last 3 months that is supposed to last us for I don't know how long. During this pandemic, billionaires have made billions, and the stock market is doing wonderful. That's why I bring on the show economist, Arash Kolahi, to explain all of this to us.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
I do want to, can I read your tweet?
Sure.
You had a tweet from the first. Rent is due today, and 1 in 5 adults say they are unable to make their rent or mortgage payment this month. Millions are unemployed. More than 50% of households have lost income. Most families are fighting on two fronts, a global pandemic and a society that is failing them. Virtually all of the economic ramifications of the pandemic were avoidable. The bankruptcies, the closing of small businesses, the looming eviction crisis, the looming credit crisis, the homelessness crisis. The U.S. was in the midst of a mental health crisis prior to the pandemic. Suicides and deaths of despair were at an all-time high. Add to that the completely preventable financial stress and anxiety of trying to survive a pandemic with little or no economic relief for the most vulnerable, yet corporations and the 1% got their trillions in handouts. Black people are being lynched. Protesters are being brutalized. Activists are being disappeared. Communities are being terrorized. Institutional oppression, authoritarianism, racism, sexism, transphobia, homophobia, etc., all further contribute to the mental health crisis. Lives are being lost. People are hurting. And the net effect of our entire political circus show is an abject failure. Or, depending on how you look at it, it's working exactly as it's supposed to, perfectly furthering the interests of the 1% at the expense of everyone else. Our societal failings go way beyond quote-unquote bad people doing quote-unquote bad things. They go way beyond this or that election. Our problems are systemic, and systemic problems need systemic analysis and systemic change. Those in power maintain their power by pushing narratives and conspiracy theories that distract and deflect the true sources of people's pain and suffering. They blame immigrants, gays, people of color, everything but the true source, a system that benefits them at our expense. Part of our job as leftists is helping connect the dots of oppression and injustice that people feel with the true systemic sources, capitalism, racism, sexism, etc. More, we need to present an alternative direction to move our society's institutions. Oh, once again, nail, head, hit it.
Sounds really good when you read it, too. I love your voice.
That's how I read it. I feel like you write it like that. I feel like when you write it, you're like, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Well, You know, I think it's important to set the stage, you know, which is one thing I try to do with that thread. Because prior to the pandemic, people were hurting, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been a 50-year one-sided class war. Most people struggling. Most people have less than $1,000 or had less than $1,000 in savings. I'm sure it's lower now. 40% of people were unable to weather a $400 expense. So, you know, it's been 50 years of the reduction of the bargaining power of the working class, right? People are struggling with dwindling savings and crushing personal debt. You know, things like credit card debt, student debt are all skyrocketing. And inequality in general is back to its, you know, pre-Great Depression levels. So things were bad to begin with. And then the pandemic hit, right? And of course, we, you know, barely got anything. Many people were left out. And, you know, like I mentioned in the thread, the 1% got their trillions. Many corporations got their bailouts, and there were plenty of handouts for those in positions of power, those who can, you know, bargain from the government to get their handouts, did get their handouts. And the most vulnerable, as usual, were left behind. So it was a bad situation to begin with. It's a bad situation now. You know, so I think it presents a lot of structural issues. You know, I think a lot of people are sort of becoming radicalized in a way by just the blatant obviousness of corruption and injustice and inequality in multiple fronts. And I think it's no coincidence, which is why I mentioned in that thread, the pervasiveness of the right pushing conspiracy theories right now. I mean, they've been doing it for years, but it's like on overdrive all throughout social media because people are looking for answers. And, you know, all of these conspiracy theories, whether it's, you know, deep state or you know, blaming of, you know, all of people's pain and suffering on immigrants or people of color or, you know, gays. I mean, they blame anything and everything, but the true source of people's pain, suffering, alienation, and feelings of injustice, right? And that's the system that benefits them at everybody else's expense. And that's why, you know, in the thread, I mentioned that, you know, us on the left, us who want to move the world in a better direction, it's absolutely imperative that we connect the dots of people's struggles, right? People's lived experiences with the systemic issues of our society, right? Capitalism, which is inherently undemocratic and inherently inequitable, right? Racism, sexism. All of these are issues that are affecting people's lives, right? Affecting people's mental health, which, you know, as I mentioned, prior to the pandemic was already at unprecedented levels. So we have our work cut out for us. We got a long way to go. But
like, yeah, 50 years of, like you said, of trying to get through a whole bunch of conspiracy theory nonsense and a war on, I've said it before and I'll say it again, you know, there's the hardcore war on science and academia, mm-hmm. That the Republican Party started, the Reagan administration to mm-hmm. me was kind of, you know, big time with that. Mm-hmm. And here we are 30, 40 years later,
Yeah.
And we're reaping what we sowed with that, because you have people so fooled, like this whole mentality of, well, I know the truth because I saw a YouTube video, or I know the truth because I don't trust the government. Mm-hmm. And it's that, to me, it's that non-trust in government. And then when you kind of hear that sentiment echoed through leadership, mm-hmm. you know, Reagan having the whole big government quote, Bill Clinton had said something about big government being bad.
Right.
And of course, Donald Trump kind of ran on a campaign of the government's corrupt because I corrupted them. Therefore, elect me because I'm the corrupter. Mm-hmm. Which didn't really make any sense to me. And him being so flippant with, like, I'm not wearing a mask because I just don't have to. like the mask is tyranny. Like that whole thing, wearing a mask is tyranny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It baffles me that people are dropping like flies.
Yeah.
And if you're not dying from this disease, you're getting extremely ill. And some people are getting, like, you know, lifelong condition, health conditions from
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Ugh. And there's so many layers to this, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, like you said, there's a strong anti-intellectualism, anti-rational thought, mm-hmm. anti-science current that's been, you know, being pushed hard in our society, right? And it's pretty obvious why, you know, those in power are behind these types of conspiracy theories. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, people are hurting. I mean, a lot of the victims of these conspiracy theories are some of, you know, the people who are not necessarily, you know, living their best lives. these are people, a lot of them are people, you know, who are struggling, who look out at the world and they see so much corruption and they see and they feel so much alienation, right? I mean, we have an extremely alienated society, and by alienation I mean, like, people feel as though they're going through their lives with virtually no real power or no real say in anything that affects their lives, like anything that matters, right? It's just like shit's just happening to them. Mm-hmm. Whether it's economic or political or even in their families, it's just like they're being bombarded. And it's, and you know, there's reasons for that, right? I mean, we don't have you know, at least not anything remotely approaching like a real democracy. So, you know, when people feel so alienated, those feelings are often justified, right? So people are and have been searching for answers. And like you mentioned yourself, like, you know, the Republicans and much of the right, like, you know, have not been able to win elections on policy, right? I
mean, exactly.
Elect us so we could, you know, screw you over is not, you know, the easiest way to win. And so, you know, maybe predictably or maybe just, you know, maybe not, but they had to find another way to win, right? And I think at least one of those ways is, you know, as you mentioned, like this whole, you know, anti-government, anti-science, anti, you know, rationalism. It's all part of the way that those in power are pushing a narrative to maintain their power, right? They're just deflecting. It's like, you know, everything you feel is real, right? It's because of, you know, X, Y, and Z, but none of those are the real causes, you know? And that's the purpose that they serve. You know what I mean?
I feel like the way they kind of pose it to that point is like, vote for me because the other guy thinks he's better than you. Yeah. And I don't know if I told you this, it's taken me like 2 months to be able to promote a lot of these shows on Facebook. I had to go through a verification process where they mail you stuff and do all this stuff to be able to post these posts. Mm-hmm. And I finally can post them, and I'm going back and reboosting older shows. And one of the older shows that I reboosted just got all this attention from these just crazy kind of pro-Trump, Cold War, Archie Bunker types, mm-hmm. like old white dudes. There's kind of the stereotypical thing you think of a Southern cat. Like, I'm an old, angry redneck, and I hate everything different. Communists want to destroy the world. And And I've been kind of engaging in
You're brave.
Some of the crap. Because, I mean, they speak nonsense. They're just like, well, if you're a communist and you hate America. And I'm like, well, explain to me what I hate. Explain to me what I'm about and explain to me what I hate. And usually they paint a picture of me as a white guy with a man bun who can't change a tire. And I'm like, bruh. You're just trying to build some sort of straw man because you don't understand what you hate. Yeah. And I feel like the right is just real good at painting a picture of what these guys just don't like. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't like the non-masculine dude that thinks he's better than you. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're against, more so than they're against. Because the policies that a lot of people are pushing for, like Medicare for all, I don't understand why somebody wouldn't want Medicare or healthcare.
Yeah.
Right. If you ask those cats, like, do you think healthcare covered under your tax dollar makes sense? They'd all say yes. Mm-hmm. But if you said communism or socialism to them, then they get really frightened because they just don't know what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of that is like the work of that, you know, the propaganda of, these groups, you know, mm-hmm. The fear that they push. It's the same thing with like climate change.
Oh. Right?
So like if you go to any, like pretty much any human being and you're like, hey, shouldn't we have, you know, clean air and water for like future generations? Like nobody's going to say no. mm-hmm. I mean, very few people are like, nah, like who cares about clean air and water? Right. Mm-hmm. But when you say the trigger words, which, you know, like, climate change, for example,
yeah,
it kind of triggers like this gut reaction that they've been sort of programmed to understand what that means, even though, you know, like you said yourself in the other example, it's a straw man, right? That's, you know, like what they think, you know, we mean by climate change is oftentimes not really what we mean, right? But of course, you know, those who benefit from, you know, not having real climate change policies, they're the ones pushing these types of propaganda to keep people, you know, just like the conspiracy theories, just like the example you gave, like, you know, it's all like this, a network of ways of maintaining a broken system. Mm-hmm. You know, it's our society is failing people and people are looking for answers. And it's just like we have to be out here and speaking truth to like the systemic problems, because right now people are so thirsty for knowing, why does their life suck so much?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why is life so alienating? Why am I so angry? Like you said, you know, like, I mean, people are angry, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there is corruption, right? There is,
yeah.
There are a lot of problems, right? Mm-hmm. And people are looking for answers. And I mean, one of the most important things I feel we can do is exactly like what you're doing with your show is trying to, you know, connect these dots, because they're not all separate struggles. They're not separate issues, right? The anger that people feel, even in the South, right? The anger that mm-hmm. people feel at their jobs where they have no say and no dignity and are treated like shit, right? Day in and day out, the anger that people feel and the alienation they feel from like always struggling to make rent and always struggling to pay their bills, those are real. And people are looking for those answers, and we cannot allow for the scapegoating, right? And the confusion that the right is trying to create to deflect the truth, right? And the truth is that these are systemic problems, and we have to speak to that, right? We have to draw connections between people's anger, people's suffering, even a large part of the mental health crisis, right? Mm-hmm. The American Psychology Association, they put out like a survey and about like the anxiety and the stress that people feel, right? And it's like no surprise. People are stressed and feel anxiety largely over like things that you probably would guess, right? Like financial stress, the direction of the country. People are genuinely stressed. And if you look at that report, it's like young people feel a lot of anxiety about climate change, right? And so these are real issues. And so we have to connect these issues to the systemic causes so that we can have hope that people will become radicalized, right? And by radicalized, what I mean by radicalized is seeing the issues in society as being systematic and thus requiring a systematic change, right? So for example, understanding how capitalism really works and seeing that much of the problems of our society are due to capitalism, then that would lead us to want to look for something better, right? So that's what I mean by radicalization, meaning that we need radical change. It's not about, getting rid of Trump, although that would be nice. It's about getting rid of a system that promotes and elevates literally the worst among us. I mean, we have a society, a political and economic system where the worst humans, the most callous, the most heartless, those who care nothing about others and just care about themselves are the ones that we elevate and that systematically get promoted to the top of our society, to the top of our structure. And that's a problem, right? That's a problem. So these are systematic problems, and they need systematic analysis, and they need systematic change.
Now, to that point, I just watched yesterday, and I couldn't watch much of it because I was yelling at the computer screen, a debate between economist Richard Wolff and this guy, I don't know his name. He's an Iranian gentleman. He has a YouTube channel that's pretty big called Valuetainment. Do you know this cat?
I don't.
I think he's down south. I should look into it, though. Huh? I mean, he's all bad, man. He's the epitome of that cat that is everything you're talking about. Hmm. He's big on bluster, very little content.
Hmm.
Just for this whole debate thing to come on, it took like 5 minutes of slick editing and music and
mm-hmm.
all this other stuff. And his whole point is capitalism is the greatest thing in the world, and America is the greatest place ever because he's an immigrant. He's got immigrant parents, and they worked hard, and that's why he's so rich, because they worked hard. And if you don't work hard and have these kind of shit values, then you're just not doing capitalism right, and it's the government's problem. And there's two examples that just kind of blew my mind in this whole exchange, and I don't understand how Richard Wolff stayed talking to this cat for as long as he did. Because the cat spent most of the time always building a straw man.
Uh-huh.
He kept trying to build a straw man to rip down. Uh-huh. And there was one point where they had a conversation about education, and the guy was like, well, education has nothing to do with capitalism. That's the government. The government creates the student loan problem, not capitalism. And I was like, what? Like, don't you know how many private companies own student loan debt?
Wow.
And then there was another part where he asked Richard Wolff, again, building the straw man, like, have you ever ran a business? You ever done this? You ever done this? You ever made a profit? Well, if you made a profit, ha-ha, you're a bad guy. That was his aha, gotcha moment.
Yeah.
And Richard Wolff's like, look, man, I exist in the world. I own shoes that are made from, you know, in Indonesia from child labor. I don't like it.
Yeah.
It's just the world I exist in. And the guy goes, look, man, I just don't care. And it's like, well, you're letting us know where your values lie.
Yeah.
You say shit like that.
Yeah. In my experience, most pro-capitalists
mm-hmm.
who are pro-capitalists mm-hmm. don't understand capitalism. they don't. I mean, even the supposed grandfather of capitalism, Adam Smith, pretty much wrote extensively about how capitalism is a really shitty system.
Mm-hmm.
How it's degrading, how it's unstable, you know, on and on. He wrote about, I mean, you'd think you're reading Marx, right?
Yeah.
Reading Adam Smith.
Wealth
but then he goes and says, you know, well, as horrible as capitalism is, it's, I can't think of anything better. I don't know how we can do better than this, mm-hmm. which I think I disagree completely with that. I think we could do better, but at least he understands the flaws of capitalism, right? I mean, to a good extent, obviously he doesn't get everything right. People who like this gentleman you're talking about, I really doubt even understands the most basic problems of capitalism. Everything from it being undemocratic to being alienating or inherently being inefficient. Capitalism is systematically inherently inefficient, and that's a fact. And it's a fact that's literally destroying the earth, right? It's the fact that capitalism misprices everything. Literally everything is mispriced. Virtually the production and consumption of every good or service has some sort of externalities, whether it's positive or negative. And in every single one of those cases, capitalism misprices that good or service, which means that the environment is undercounted in capitalism inherently and systematically. And if you don't understand that, you just simply don't understand capitalism. And, you know, people come out and very confidently say stupid shit, right? The thing that gives them confidence is not that they're right, right? So like this guy can just come out and boast like, oh, like, you know, capitalism, this is great, you know, so on and so forth. It's not based in any reality. It's based on the entire propaganda system that's got their back, right? I mean,
yeah.
Unlike those of us who try to, you know, speak truth to power or try to look at the systematic issues of our society, we don't have the luxury of, you know, the entire establishment, right? The entire political and economic establishment, and their, you know, mainstream media and their even academia to a certain extent, you know, the whole echo chamber that gives them that sort of confidence to come out and in all honesty, you know, what would be literally laughable statements that this guy is making is not laughable, or people are not laughing, is really just, you know, just a function of how much that propaganda system has maintained the most ridiculous lies about capitalism, right? Because the things I'm talking about capitalism are not necessarily controversial, right? I mean, there's not, you know, I mean, it's not like anybody really thinks capitalism is, capitalist workplaces are democratic or they're not alienating. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Nobody's saying that. But it's a fundamental, there are some, you know, economists who really downplay the environmental destruction of capitalism, which is of course a problem. But, you know, my point is that, like, you know, people can come out and say things really confidently, but there's really zero theoretical or historical evidence to back up what they're saying. It's the only reason they could come out and say things with such confidence is because of that propaganda system that's got their back.
And it's so crazy because, like, there's another part of the debate where they're talking about monopoly, and Richard Wolff is trying to explain how monopoly is inherent in capitalism. And this gentleman says monopoly can't happen unless the government lets it happen.
Yeah, I mean.
And so Richard Wolff goes, the guy goes, well, give me one example. And Richard Wolff goes, Microsoft. And the guy, he kind of is baffled by that response because he's like, what? Because he doesn't know about the whole, like, lawsuit in the 90s. And then Richard Wolff goes, Amazon. And the guy goes, name one thing on Amazon that's not cheap. I'm like, what's that have to do with monopoly?
Yeah. Yeah.
So can you, is it possible for you to kind of explain real quick how monopoly is inherent in capitalism?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so capitalism inherently rewards bargaining power. Mm-hmm. So it has a tendency to give more. And by give more, I mean, if you look at, for example, like prices. Right? The price of things being bought and sold in an economy. Below a certain price, right? The seller's not going to want to sell it because they're going to lose money, right? And above a certain price, the buyer is not going to want to buy it because they can, you know, it's either too expensive or they could find an alternative. But somewhere within that range is a place where both the buyer and seller will agree on that transaction. Right. Every single time, what happens in capitalism is that within that range, right, the price will always be beneficial to the party that has more power between the buyer and the seller. So whoever has more power, in this case, in the example you brought up, say, for example, like Amazon, right? And they can use their bargaining power in different ways, which we can get into. But just looking at the price. So, you know, millions of transactions that occur between consumers and Amazon, right? The price will always benefit Amazon,
mm-hmm.
right? So between that range, it's always going to be that the lion's share of the benefit goes to the more powerful entity, right? And the same thing is true of international trade, right? So, you know, if you look at, you know, impoverished countries producing some good, right, that have very low bargaining power relative to the international market, when they bring their products to the international market, because they have such low bargaining power, right, within that range, right, within that floor and that ceiling, the price will always be to the disadvantage of the impoverished country and to the advantage of the wealthier country. So everything from international trade down to, you know, a local economy, the most fundamental aspect, one of the most fundamental aspects of capitalism, is that the lion's share of the benefit of every transaction, right, the lion's share, meaning that the majority of the benefit goes to the already more powerful entity. And so over time, the more powerful will get more powerful. And the weak will get weaker. And that's one of the tendencies for monopolies to develop, right? There are others, but that's a systematic and can be backed by theoretical evidence as well as historical evidence. Like I was saying, some bozo can get up and confidently say stupid shit, but these are the facts, right?
Yeah.
Capitalism systematically and inherently will tend towards making them already powerful more powerful, and everybody kind of intuitively knows it, right? Like, you need money to make money, right? I mean, those are kind of things that we say, but it has an underlying meaning to it, right? When it comes to mergers and acquisitions, it's the more powerful entity that gobbles up the smaller ones, right? It's the more powerful Amazon that gobbles up the hundreds of thousands of small businesses that they put out of business. Okay. So inherently, capitalism does, as you said, tend towards monopolization, right? Because the more powerful the entity, the more they can extract from each and every transaction, and then the more powerful they would become. And eventually, that includes their competitors, right? And there's so many layers to this, right? Because it also brings to light that the worst actors become the monopolies, not the best, right? So imagine there was, not Amazon, but some other competitor to Amazon, an online retailer. Mm-hmm. And let's suppose hypothetically that this online retailer actually cared about their employees and actually cared about the environment. And so they paid their employees equitably, and they incurred, millions and millions of dollars of additional costs to minimize the effect of their business on the economy. They will be put out of business. They won't be able to compete with the company that doesn't give a shit. That's a fundamental systematic flaw of capitalism, that those who care the least, right? And earlier I was saying we have a society, right, that systematically brings the worst actors to the top. It also happens in capitalism systematically and inherently, where those who don't care about their employees, those who don't care about the environment, and literally those who don't give a shit about anything other than maximizing their own profit, always, always, always will have a competitive advantage over those that do, and will eventually put those that do care out of business. Fundamental flaw of capitalism. Another fundamental flaw. So not only does capitalism tend towards creating monopolies, but it will also tend towards creating monopolies of the worst of the worst of the worst.
I also think people don't understand. I think when we think monopoly, we think the game, and we think one person standing on top, or maybe if you have even some sort of historical reference, you think just Standard Oil, or Ma Bell. And you forget, like, the airline industry is a monopoly. There's like a handful of companies, and they all work together to control prices.
Yeah.
Like, get your carry-on luggage from 10 years ago and see how much bigger it was than it is now.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's, plenty of examples. All the ones that you brought up are great examples. The airlines is a great example of where, the tendency of capitalism is to just have a handful of enterprises that do collude with each other to price fix, and to sort of standardize ways of fleecing, customers, and even competitors. A lot of times, you know, groups like these will basically, you know, gang up to prevent any new competitor from coming in into the market, right? So they may all get together and say, hey, you know, so-and-so is trying to come into our space. You know, let's all, you know, all of a sudden lower our prices for a number of months, put them out of business, and then we'll raise our prices back up. I mean, that's things, those are the types of things that happen. And that's kind of just naturally occurring phenomenon in capitalism.
I don't know if you know, I forget the name of the company that owns the patents for all glasses.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter what kind of glasses you have, there's one company that makes them. So if you get the Polo glasses or Gucci glasses, there's just this one company that makes them, puts the Gucci name on them. And Oakley was trying to like, no, we're Oakley and our glasses are special because we're Oakley and we're going to keep making ours. And they're like, nope. And they almost put Oakley out of business.
Mm.
Because they were like, no, we are the glasses people. You have to go through us if you want to sell your designer glasses.
Yeah.
And how expensive are glasses?
You know? Yeah. Yeah. I don't know about this particular case. I'd be interested to look into it. But I can add to that the entire patent system is just completely broken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it largely prevents the type of in like science and technology, usually, you know, like if you look at, for example, open source communities,
mm-hmm.
Where people collaborate and work together to further technological progress, you know, as happens often in academia, right, where we stand on the shoulder of giants to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
Patents tend to prevent a lot of that from happening, right? And that's another problem of capitalism, right? Again, a lot of these things are systematic. One of the major problems of capitalism is that it does not reward people for anything remotely equitable. It doesn't reward people for their effort or sacrifice or how long they work, or how hard they work towards socially valued production and consumption and research and so on, right? So people who are doing research, like, for example, on a better way of doing glasses,
mm-hmm.
right, have no way of being compensated, right, or are very unlikely to be compensated for their efforts unless they seek a patent, because capitalism has no way of rewarding them for their research, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's another fundamental problem of capitalism, is that I don't want to say capitalism requires patents, because it certainly doesn't, but it's also a logical extension of the logic of capitalism that, hey, in order for me to get, you know, to get rewarded for my efforts for coming up with this invention, I need to patent it so that then I can, you know, monopolize that particular invention and finally be rewarded for all my efforts, right? That's the logic of capitalism. But again, it's flawed. And it thus tends to necessitate a system like the patent system for people to be able to extract wealth and income, because capitalism has no way of doing it otherwise.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
A much more logical system. You know, I really like, and I, you know, I've tweeted about it a few times. I really like a theoretical kind of economic system called participatory economics. And one of the, you know, cornerstones of participatory economics is people being rewarded for their effort and sacrifice and for the time, you know, for things that they actually have control over, right? So they're rewarded equitably for production and consumption, or I'm sorry, for the production or the work of things that have social value. And you know, like we're talking about research and coming out with, you know, the next vaccine or the next, you know, medical innovation, these are highly socially valued. And capitalism is completely incapable of rewarding that research, right? Which is, of course, why, you know, a lot of it happens within academia. But it's also, there's something to be said for having a better economic system that would actually rectify that, right? That would actually say, hey, this type of research is valuable and people should be rewarded for that. And then you don't need patents, right? Because people would be rewarded for the work that they do on, in doing that research and coming up with the next, you know, invention or so on. They would be rewarded equitably. And, you know, the entire patent system at that point would be moot.
So like right now, I forget how many hundreds of companies are fighting for the patent to get the first vaccine for COVID-19. Mm-hmm. I guess the downside to this, as my girl works in medical research and she was explaining to me, she goes, when things like this happen, when Trump is so cut off from the world scientific community, we're not sharing information. Mm-hmm. And when scientists and doctors aren't sharing this information, sometimes the research doesn't go as far as it could go.
Absolutely. 100%.
This to me seems like an inherent flaw in capitalism right there.
It is. It is. People monopolize information in capitalism because what do we talk about? How do you get paid in capitalism? If you're an enterprise, you get paid by your bargaining power. And knowledge is power. Inventions are power, right? If you hold some piece of information, even if it's not patented, this isn't necessarily even about patents. It's about the underlying incentive. The underlying incentive of capitalism is to hoard information and hoard knowledge that would give you a leg up on your competitors. That's built into capitalism. And that is one of the reason why capitalism, contrary to the propaganda, stifles creativity and stifles innovation. Mm-hmm. Right? Like you just mentioned, if instead the incentive was to collaborate and put our knowledge and our resources together, knowing that, you know, like I mentioned, we would all be rewarded and paid equitably for our efforts. So there is no need now to hoard this information. Now we have the correct incentive, right? Now we have an incentive to collaborate and to do what science has almost always been about, which is building upon previous knowledge. Right, building upon the inventions of others. Most progress in science and technology are built upon previous work that has been done by others. Right? Mm-hmm. And so, again, systematic problems of capitalism, right? It has the wrong incentives. It incentivizes hoarding of information, hoarding of knowledge, because capitalism rewards bargaining power, which is horrible. We need to move beyond that, right?
Mm-hmm. But that's the thing that's kind of scary. Lori Garrett, infectious disease expert, was just on Democracy Now! Recently, and she was talking about the problems that we face, and she says COVID-19, she thinks will be around for 3 years at least. Mm-hmm. And she was kind of giving like best case scenario situations for finding a vaccine and how you're going to, how it would have to be liquid. It can't be syringe vaccine. You can't need a booster for it, 'cause all these things take longer. They cost more. Mm-hmm. And she made an interesting point. She goes, whatever country finds it first, their country's going to get it first. And she goes, if China finds it first, and she wasn't saying this is any anti-China comment. Mm-hmm. She says, that's 1.4 billion people that you have to make a vaccine for first, before it goes anywhere else.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think when you have this, to our earlier point, when you have this conspiracy theory community of anti-vaccination and, you know, the government's injecting me with stuff, they don't understand the huge undertaking that injecting them with stuff would be. Mm. And for what purpose?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the freedoms that you think the stuff injection would take away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one thing I always try to get across to people when they say, and I always say, well, why would the government want to inject you with stuff? And they're like, well, to control my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, why? What would your mind need to be controlled for? What is it that you're doing that? So you're speaking to me. I live in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We're not speaking off the grid in a commune somewhere.
Right.
So what about you needs to be so controlled,
mm-hmm,
by the government? Or then you get the kind of eco-fascist, well, it's all population control. And
yeah. I mean, even that whole concept of freedom, right? I mean, freedom without power over the decisions that affect your life are somewhat meaningless. You know what I mean? Like, I think we talked about this on a previous show, but like, mm-hmm, it's a flawed conception of freedom to think like you can just walk down the street and punch somebody in the face. You know what I mean? Like, that's not freedom. Why? Because you now punching somebody in the face affects others. So fundamental to the concept of freedom and self-determination is the idea of who is affected by what, right? So, you know, like things like vaccines, they, by deciding not to get a vaccine, you're also affecting, you know, the society you live in. You know, by deciding not to wear a mask, right? Mm-hmm. If that's your conception of freedom, it's a slightly flawed conception of freedom. I mean, there's videos of people like getting so upset.
Temper tantrums
by being asked to put on a mask that they literally will spit and cough in people's faces that ask them to put on a mask. Is that freedom? I mean, should we be free to affect other people like, mm-hmm, that? Mm-hmm. That's a flawed conception of freedom, right? I mean, to me, you know, and we talked about this previously, but to me, you know, the ideal that I believe we want to strive for in a society, in the aspect of freedom, is that for people to have a say in decisions in proportion to the degree that the decision affects them. So if you want to do something that doesn't affect anybody, by all means, do it, right? You want to, in your house, you know, paint your bedroom bright orange or whatever, nobody's going to tell you. But once you do something that, mm-hmm, starts to affect other people, then those other people should also now have a right to have a say in that matter. How much of a say? A say in proportion to the degree that they are affected. So if they're greatly affected by, you know, the fact that you want to store toxic waste in your backyard that can cause cancer to your neighbors, well, hell yeah, you shouldn't be free to do that because you're affecting other people with that, right? It's causing cancer to your neighbors. So I think the whole conception of freedom needs a little bit of work, right? I mean, it has to take into consideration power dynamics. It has to take into consideration the effect of who's affected by what. And I think once you add that to your concept of freedom, right, I think it's a corrective, right? It corrects the concept of freedom that you're free to do as you wish so long as you affect nobody else. But once you affect others, then they now have a right, right? I mean, kind of like democracy in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. Freedom and democracy, in my opinion, kind of go hand in hand. You can't, it's kind of ridiculous to have one without the other. So, you know, freedom without other people who are now affected by those decisions being able to have a say in that decision is not a good conception of freedom, right? I mean, you're now screwing other people and affecting their lives, and they get no say in that matter. So, yeah, I think definitely we need to kind of rethink the concepts of freedom and democracy, and move our society in a way that's far more free and far more democratic than it is now. Because the reality is that we're neither free or democratic right now, to a large extent.
No, we're not free. We don't have a lot of the things that, you know, again, as I rebut all these people that say that these shows I have are communist propaganda to take over the United States. And as one man said to me, in closing, he said, that I am ruining a great country, which I thought was somewhat amusing. That's like, all right. The freedoms we lack. We don't really have a free press. We definitely don't have free and fair elections. Mm-hmm. We have a two-party duopoly that people are very much invested in, but we never talk about third parties. And when you look at most other nations, developed and undeveloped, they have several parties to vote for, and that actually have a loud voice in the election. Mm-hmm. Moving forward, and I know you said it on the last show, but we just need to keep reiterating this point. What do we need to do moving forward so we can try to regain some semblance of freedom, or acquire, I shouldn't say regain, acquire a semblance of freedom and get away from the system that we're living in right now that is oh so corrosive? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a lot we can do, you know, and you're doing it, I think, with your show. One is, you know, raising consciousness, connecting the dots of oppression, of alienation and suffering that people feel in their lives that they know is very true and very real. Connecting those with the real and true systematic causes of the pain that they feel. From capitalism to racism to sexism to homophobia and transphobia, you know, ableism, all of these are systematic problems that are affecting the quality of our lives and our mental health. Mm-hmm. And we need to move our society in a more fulfilling way, meaning that the inherent structures of our social institutions are more fulfilling, are less alienating, right? Are more rich and more fulfilling, and make us feel, rather than feel oppressed, feel good about our interactions with one another, whether it's economic or political or in the kinship sphere or in the community sphere. And to do that, we have to understand, you know, the systematic problems of our society and present them in a way to people that that the solution will require systematic change, right? That the system itself is fundamentally flawed. And not until we move our society, move our economy, right, from capitalism to a better economic system, right? That rather than being alienating and exploitative and inequitable and all of these flaws and environmentally destructive, move it towards an economy that is democratic, right? That is that takes into consideration the environment, right? These are fundamental changes that need to happen to move our society in a better direction. And I think, you know, these types of conversations that we're having today and that we've been having are important. It's important to kind of talk to the systematic problems and talk about systematic solutions. And I think that does a great deal, right? And then the second thing is, of course, you know, how do we actually win? And, you know, I have a few threads on it, but, you know, of course, there's a huge diversity of tactics, right? Historically, most of, at least my understanding of history, is that most of the gains that we have today are the result of, you know, things like civil disobedience, strikes, ways of forcing those in power to change, because people in power will not voluntarily give up their power. And it's not until people rise up and demand for change that it's actually going to come.
Well, we're seeing it right now.
Yes.
Maybe in an unprecedented moment. And here in Oakland, California, we actually had a bill passed to remove police officers from the public schools. And apparently the woman that's been behind that fight, it's been a 10-year struggle for that to happen, to kind of give people an idea that it is definitely a marathon. It is not a race.
Absolutely.
And we can't get too caught up in Black Lives Matter boulevards. And yeah. Well, even where you live, I know they're talking about defunding the police by $150 million, and I haven't read too much into that. Is it really a defunding or is it a shifting of money, which happens more often than not?
I don't know. I did see some headlines about it, but I don't know the details.
Yeah, there's always the devil is always in the details.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah. Also in schools here too, they're talking about taking the police out of schools, which is a major problem in Los Angeles.
Police in schools? Are they in your children's schools?
No. Well, my daughter is in elementary, so.
You would hope not.
I right? would hope not. But it's definitely a problem in high schools.
It is a problem because I don't think people understand when there's police in your schools for a lot of these youthful indiscretions that you get at schools without police, drug use, cutting class, fighting, and you can go on with your life when you don't have police in your schools. When you have police in your schools and these things happen, now you have a record.
Yeah.
Now you're in the system.
Yeah.
So, Arash, thank you so much again for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you.
I want to keep having you on as much as I can. The economist of the show. I don't care what you say. That's what you are.
All right. I love it.
All right. I'm going to play some music. Don't hang up.